It don't, no. My kid, okay, yeah, he might have did a little drugs or whatever. Who didn't when they was at that age, okay? That's another thing they trashed my kid down with. You know, they put it in the newspaper all the time talking about his, you know, his back history. Okay, how you like that if everybody go put back their back history and splatter after you just got killed by a serial killer? Come on now.
He's not here to defend himself.
Yeah. I said, like, you know, 23 kids, come on now. You tell me you couldn't catch this man way before that? It took that many people? Come on. You know, I don't understand that.
It was just like a big old disaster, you know. Things, you know, this person getting killed, you know. Then you turn around, that's another one, you know. Like, it was just, I thought it wouldn't go in the way it was going.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, also writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards. I'm a criminal behavioral analyst, advocate and author, and also founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and co-creator of CBS's show, The Case of JonBenet Ramsey.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague. He is a writer and producer on the show. And every so often during the season, we get to work together on one of his scripts. And you want to talk about your latest script?
Yeah, well, hopefully our listeners were able to watch Wednesday night the latest episode that I wrote called A Good Husband. And it was an episode that explored the horrible world of coercive control. And that is when one partner in a relationship controls the other one by doing things that outwardly appear to be helpful, but actually maintain tremendous control and over time lock down their partner into a situation where they do not have any choices in their life, that they're being completely manipulated and their humanity is stolen from them, right, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, it's sadly, you know, it's a form of domestic terrorism, and it's where one really does micromanage another and limits their space for action. And as you quite rightly say, Jim C., it can be seen as sort of attentive behavior or pseudo-caring behavior. And it's very insidious and under the skin, but it's a pattern, and normally it goes on for a long time. And many people who are victimized don't even realize that they're being victimized.
Things like the husband offering to drive their partner to work and picking them up after work and driving them to the store and cleaning and cooking at home and making sure that they have everything they want and making sure that every single thing that they do in their life is provided to them by their partner. It sounds like, wow,
yeah,
this is,
like,
you hit the jackpot.
Yeah, exactly.
But what you find is they're also not allowed to speak unless spoken to, that they're not allowed to have friends outside of the relationship, that the partner looks at their cell phone and calls every number on it to make sure who that other person is and what the relationship is, cuts them off from their friends, prevents them from going out and just being alone and being on their own time. And all these things actually put that person in bondage. And it's a love bondage, because that victimized person thinks that the other person is doing it out of love and then slowly loses self. So in this particular episode, I wanted to set that in a different setting. And so it's set in Palm Springs, and it's set in the midst of a gay marriage. And this marriage actually is one that is breaking up because of the coercive control, because the friends of this victim have helped him recognize the fact that he is in a coercively controlled relationship and that he's trying to get away. But as a result of that, the partner lashes out. And lashes out with homicide.
And Laura, can you talk about how many times it takes people to try to leave, or is there? Do you have any like statistics on how long it could take somebody to try to get out of this relationship? And it usually take friends to intervene, or
Well, on average, it's about seven times that someone will try and leave. And, you know, of course, we've got to remember that normally the victim loves this person and they're emotionally, you know, in turmoil because they love the person that they're with, but they want the abusive behavior to stop. So they want the relationship normally to go back to where it was when it first began, because we don't fall in love with people who are abusive. It tends to happen over time. And it is a control thing. And that's the real challenge with it. It's a power and control dynamic. And, you know, normally the abuser says they're going to change and they're going to modify their behavior and they're going to do all the things that will make it right. But sadly, it's these it's the smaller things, actually, that erode the person's sense of self. And it's an erosion of who they are and their self-esteem and their self-worth. So actually, they feel that they can't leave in some senses because people won't want them either. And I think it's very hard for people who love, you know, the family and friends who are around that person to try and support them. But there is help, and, you know, there is life after abuse, and that's an important part to telling the story. You know, there are many victims who do survive, who do get out safely, and we want absolutely for the focus to be on the perpetrator and them changing their behaviour and forcing them to take responsibility and change that behaviour. And it became a crime. We lobbied and campaigned for it to become a crime in England and Wales, which it did in 2015, and we're seeing great results in terms of outcomes of victims being able to leave safely and, you know, abusers at the serious level going to prison. But it's probably worthy of saying, you know, whilst in the UK we're criminalising it, and I was in Stormont 2 weeks ago talking about criminalising coercive control, and Professor Evan Stark had previously given evidence as well, and about criminalising stalking. There are other places around the world, Russia in particular, hugely concerning that they are looking to decriminalise, and they're looking to see it as a much lesser offence.
One other thing I want to ask you, Jim, about your episode. In your episode, the friends that orbit this couple, they end up getting hurt. And I mean, I would imagine that really does happen, that the abuser will lash out at other people, and there's a lot of jealousy and that kind of thing.
Well, I think that the story that I told, and with all the stories that I tell through writing Criminal Mind scripts, I do try to blend in teaching points from real cases. And so, yes, that can happen. And although what I do also is try to blend multiple cases together so that it's not just relying on the facts of one case and dredging up things for one particular family or a set of families. And so I still want people to understand the real teaching points, because I think that's a real important obligation on our part, because we have such a good forum, because we are reaching not only tens of millions of people in the United States, but tens of millions of people around the world. And I think it's an amazing opportunity to help inform the public while they're being entertained and while they're trying to use their mind to figure out the cases that we cover in Criminal Minds. In this particular case, yes, there were victims who were actually close to this particular couple. And what happened was the offender realizes at some point that if he kills people close to them, that he could frighten his partner into coming back. And he uses that as the ultimate form of manipulation. And it isn't until that realization hits the partner that A, he was being victimized and manipulated, but B, this guy actually was killing their friends to make it happen, that he became so horrified and so forth. So there's a real underlying theme in this. We tried to be somewhat subtle in terms of displaying what coercive control was, the ways in which they interacted, even physically. The offending partner would put his arms on his partner's throat or around his back. I mean, just slightly controlling maneuvers that actually were, when you take them all together with his over concern, with his micromanaging his partner's life, mm-hmm. with everything having to be exactly perfect and along these lines, I think we tried to, and hopefully we did, show that coercive control can be very subtle, something that you wouldn't necessarily recognize, even if it was happening right in front of you.
I know we worked really hard in the casting to have, you know, a couple that we can all relate to, and you know, the abused partner, you know, was very fit and could defend himself. I mean, it wasn't like
he just didn't know he had to defend himself. He thought he was being cared for. He thought he was being taken care of. And in fact, what was happening was he was being forced into an ever tightening corner where he didn't have any say in anything that he did in his life. And fortunately, he had good friends who explained this to him and gave him an opportunity to escape from it.
Okay.
And that's, you know, people can escape safely from it. And, you know, one of the things that we see is that when someone does try and separate, of course, that does increase the risk. So, you know, leaving is the risky time. And that's when the stalking behavior happens. We would then call it stalking, but actually it's the same behaviors as coercive control. And that's why we really, in England and Wales, wanted to create the opportunity for early intervention and prevention and identification, and have the criminal offence at the time when all the psychological things are happening before it escalates and turns physical. And then on separation, we call it stalking. So, you know, there certainly is, when we risk assess cases, we do look at what we call the protected buffers. Those people around the victims who are trying to support them and care for them, that the perpetrator may see as challenges and issues and may start to act out towards them too. So, you know, in any one case, we may be risk assessing at least two or three people. So we want to make sure we do understand risk, and we give advice to the victims and friends and family about how to work together and how to coordinate the response and keep that person safe, particularly at the point that they choose to leave.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jim, for, you know, letting us talk about your episode. And I know that we're going to move on now to this series of episodes that we're calling The Killing Bayous. You want to take us back to where we were when we left off?
Sure. In our last episode of Real Crime Profile, we started discussing one of the serial killers that was operating in New Orleans between 1997 and 2005. Seven local parishes. Parishes are what they refer to. We would call them counties in other places. And between these seven parishes, 23 men were killed over the course of just about 10 years. And during that time period, it took quite a bit of time before a task force was set up to actually deal with the fact that these men were being brutally murdered and just dumped like trash on the side of the road or in a dumpster.
18 bodies, and then the task force is formally
put in place. And it's just, it's terrible. It's a very negative message from law enforcement, about law enforcement, when just because these men were African-American, some of them were gay, some of them were street workers, some of them were drug dealers, some of them were white. They were poor people who didn't have much say in the community and who lost their voice completely because this particular serial killer took advantage of them, took advantage of their vulnerability.
The other thing to say, to put this in its context at the time, of course, there are other predatory serial offenders at work at the same time as this case. But of course, what's noteworthy is that they're a different victim type. So, you know, it's not that victims or cases are being linked incorrectly. It's just the fact that the case isn't being linked and being seen as the work of one predatory individual. And I know at the time there was another high profile case of a mother who killed her two children, and that seemed to garner a huge amount of media attention and police resource as well. So, you know, there's something absolutely about the victimology here, which is why the resources aren't being put into it, even though the victimology, there is diversification. And I'm sure that this comes down to availability and opportunity. As we know, perpetrators and offenders will choose a particular victim at a particular time for a particular reason. But in this particular case, he did diversify. even though he did have a preferred victim type, and that could well come down, as Jim C and I know, to need-driven behaviour, along with the availability and opportunity. But things certainly ramp up when, you know, other victims are targeted. And in particular, I think Mitchell Johnson, again, was probably a very significant change in what happened to him, the ninth victim that unfortunately crossed paths with this dangerous and predatory offender. And I believe, Jim, were the FBI, were you involved in this particular case, or was the FBI at the time?
Yeah, well, not until this particular case was the FBI involved, but at this point, this was the game changer. This is when, and, you know, it's unbelievable, when they approached the FBI, the local detectives told us that, well, we got bodies dropping in this parish, we got bodies dropping in that parish, we got bodies now dropping in a third parish, so we think there might be a problem here. What the fuck? I mean, give me a break. So this is the first time they decided that after now the ninth victim, nine men have now been brutally killed, that they are actually going to start a task force to bring together the parishes and the state police and the FBI and tell us about this case. So he was, Mitchell Johnson was actually, became a victim in a very different way, and that we actually have two eyewitnesses to how he met up with RD. RD approached him while Mitchell was walking along the street with his two nieces. He had just gone to the store with them, and he was approached by this white guy who sort of was short and dumpy and overweight and very kind of meek. And he said to Mitchell that this woman wanted to have sex with a black guy and she would pay him for that sex. And he showed Mitchell a picture, a Polaroid picture of this woman. And he said, why don't we just get rid of your two nieces here and then you can come with me and you can have sex with this woman. They dropped the nieces off back at their house. And then Mitchell Johnson was never seen alive again.
Now, but the nieces didn't say that that's how he was lured away, right? The nieces, this is coming from RD.
No, they said that he had a conversation with this guy. He showed him a picture of a white woman, and then he dropped us off, and then he went off with the guy. And it was later, more detail was given by RD, but the fact is that this is a fairly complicated ruse that shows that RD is not only capable of brutal murder, but also of posing as somebody who's meek and mild-mannered and not scary or offensive or threatening in any way. And he's using that, his stature, his physicality or lack thereof, his sort of high-pitched voice and his meek nature as a lure to lower the defenses of these people. And obviously, he's smart enough to pick and choose between what ruse he uses in order to get somebody who happens to be straight or somebody who happens to be gay as a victim.
What does it say to you guys that he didn't care that there were two witnesses?
I think he felt that he had gotten away with eight previous murders. He didn't see any kind of big media attention or law enforcement attention to this. And he thought he was bulletproof at this point. He thought, I can do anything. It was emboldening him. He was feeling very powerful and in control. And that excited him. And so he took the step of actually approaching someone, even though there were two child eyewitnesses. He probably also thought, these kids won't remember me, the kids won't be good witnesses, and therefore I'm free to go.
I would absolutely think that he is emboldened at this time. And certainly, you know, previously he did get away with things. And again, you know, we just don't know how many near misses there have been, do we, in terms of how many other victims that he'd gone up to, had discussions with, and certainly, you know, we're getting to how he was arrested, but there were a handful of people who he had spoken with and who he had tried to lure into various situations and who he had got so far with, and he didn't seem to be too concerned about being compromised. And in fact, I mean, actually, there was another rape reported about him in 1993 where he tried to rape somebody at gunpoint and the charges were dropped as well. So we just know in every case there are just so many other people who have been approached. I always call them the near misses, and nobody's knocking on his door. So he's thinking that he is getting away with it. And I mean, actually, just looking at this, Jim C., it seems to be it was actually after the Nick Pellegrin, wasn't it, the 18th case, that the actual task force was formed. So it's after 18 bodies where the actual task force with the FBI was involved. So it seems to be even further along the line that a very proactive response was put together. Is that your recollection?
Well, my recollection was after Mitchell Johnson. I mean, that was the first case I found out about, and I thought it was when it just happened. It may have been later, but I'm pretty sure it was after the 9th case that they started the task force. Mitchell Johnson stood out because there were actual eyewitnesses to the victim being approached by somebody. Of course, at that point, you would think this is going to be easy. This for law enforcement to solve. They have a very good, a decent description anyway, not only of the potential offender, but of that offender's MO. And because of that, they could have put word out on the street to people who, you know, who looked like these guys, like the victims, who acted like these victims. They could have put undercovers out. They could have done a lot of proactive investigative steps that would have minimized the chances of anybody else dying. But this would go on and on and on for years. Yeah. And the victim toll would rise over and over and over again to at least 23 young men.
And before we move on, I just wanted to read a couple things from Darlene, who was Mitchell Johnson's sister. And it was her two little girls who were walking with him when he disappeared. And they remembered RD's face when they finally did see his face on television. They did remember him. But anyway, she says, he was a good person. He worked since he was 15. He wasn't homeless and he wasn't a prostitute. They do him justice for what he did to my brother. She's talking about RD. When they do him justice for what he did to my brother, because he didn't ask for that. And I know just reading and hearing what he did to him and what he was thinking when he was strangling him and raping him. Darlene believes that her brother was drugged before he was strangled and raped because he showed no signs of struggle. So we're going to hold that thought. And when we come back, we'll continue talking about the Killing Bayous.
And it's wasn't uncommon on a few of these scenes to be able to be standing at one murder scene and literally looking at another one in eyesight, a distance away, like this one.
And we are back, and we're continuing our discussion of each of the victims that had been killed in these serial cases taking place in Louisiana.
Another victim, Anoka Jones, was found in St. Charles Parish. This would lead to a string of other victims.
Anoka was 26. He was of Uma, which is just outside of New Orleans, and he was found under U.S. Highway 90 overpass in Butte in St. Charles Parish on October 2002, and he'd been strangled.
Yeah. So he was one of the victims that was found, you know, very close to a highway, not very well hidden, but again, just discarded like rubbish people throw out of their cars. And again, that's an indicator for us behaviorally that that the offender actually despised or thought very badly of these victims. These were truly marginalized people who did not have a voice in the community and therefore did not really have a big law enforcement or media response.
Yeah, you're going to see a big contrast in some of the other cases we're going to cover. The community listened to certain people in these other cases, but certainly not in this RD case.
Yeah. So the next victim of this serial killer was Leon Lurette.
Yeah, and again, not much is known about him. I was able to find one newspaper article that interviewed his mother and his brother, and she just expresses being so stunned when she found out that he was dead that she almost fell to her knees. And, you know, again, these are people living, they're living in trailers, and she describes him as being a good boy, but, you know, he didn't always have a job, but that doesn't mean that, you know, he deserved to be targeted and victimized. So it seemed like it was a long time before law enforcement would even update her on if they'd even found his killer. You know, she just seems really heartbroken about, you know, the whole thing.
Yeah, well, when victims are marginalized, their surviving family members are marginalized as well. And it's so frustrating. And I know I've had to deal with a number of victims over the course of my career, and certainly Laura has as well, where they felt that law enforcement does not actually understand or take into account that these were actually real human beings. They deserve just as much attention as any wealthy, white or prominent person in the community deserved in terms of getting justice for having been murdered. I mean, in fact, isn't that the basis for why you started Paladin? Because the people who were being stalked in the UK, they weren't getting enough attention and protection from law enforcement.
Yes, it certainly was. I mean, the advocacy side is still, you know, a huge piece of work in lots of different areas of advocating for those who are voiceless or who have been silenced forever. And, you know, of course, we've got many here who have been silenced forever, and the families who don't have the means or the ability or capacity to speak out. I think even at the press conferences, there were a number of families who were outside who, even, you know, when RD was arrested, they weren't even allowed in the room and didn't know any details about what had gone on or who it was who had been arrested. And I just think that's, you know, even at that point, it just tells a story really about what was going on here, and the context of that is really important. I think it's so sad that we can't find enough information from the victim's point of view of their lives and their contribution to this world before they unfortunately cross paths with RD. And of course, we're still saying RD, the initials. We're intentionally not mentioning any of the serial killers in the cases that we're discussing, because many of them do seek that notoriety.
Right.
And we really are trying to redress the balance here. So it is with intention that we are not naming them.
Yeah, you know, Laura, just in that vein, I would like to make a statement that I belong to a number of professional groups that deal with professionals in the area of serial murders and serial rapes. And recently, one of them put out a open letter to the media that I signed off on, and because we've been teaching for years, and I learned this from Dr. Park Dietz, that the more we give a name to the offender, the more we encourage copycats and encourage future offenders to actually do things that are bigger and badder and more explosive and more media worthy. So if we actually deliberately do not name them, do not give them that power in the community, in the media, even in social media, we will actually undermine their expectations. We will actually undermine their plans and make it less likely that somebody's going to want to do this for a grandstanding event.
We just give them too much power. And obviously all that they're seeking is power and control. And even, you know, from prison, we're giving them a platform. And that's exactly, you know, I think we all feel strongly about that, certainly on our podcast, Real Crime Profile, that we don't give them the platform and the voice to speak out, that we make sure that we redress the balance and give the victims the platform. They deserve to be honoured. And we also, you know, want to train and educate people of how you can learn, you know, in terms of safety and what are the key risk markers and risk factors as well. It's all really important.
I was just going to say that, you know, not only just their given names, but, you know, these these names that the media comes up with that make them larger than life, like, you know, the Bayou Butcher or the whatever, you know, that's even worse because it really lifts them into a mythology that I mean, until I really started working on this podcast with you, I think I just accepted that, you know, it didn't even occur to me, even like the Zodiac Killer or the this and the that. But now I'm so aware of it. And I think things are changing. I can see that in the media now that things are
What was great was, you know, my brother and I and Bobby Chacon and Chris Voss and a lot of our other colleagues, Steve Moore, who you've heard on Real Crime Profile. We've been telling that to the media for many years now, and I think they're actually, I know that a number of times when I've gone on CNN to talk about events that occur that, you know, Don Lemon will not use the offender's name anymore, which is great. And I think other CNN anchors and other hosts across the board on news programs are now sort of catching on that we can actually take back control from these horrible criminals and not give them what they want and also not encourage future criminals from trying to outdo the ones in the past. So with that in mind, we'll move on to yet the next victim, victim number 12, Angel Mejia.
Yeah, and the only thing I could find out about Angel, he was 19 years old. He's found next to a dumpster in a small town called Kenner, and he'd been strangled. He did have a family. That's all I could find out about this kid.
Yeah, and I remember when we covered this case that Angel might have been a little bigger than the prior victim who had actually been put into a dumpster. And I think that the offender did attempt or hope to throw this victim actually in the dumpster, but maybe he couldn't. And that gave us an indicator that either he was not physically strong or not big of stature, or that he might have been injured at the time and maybe even in this interaction. And that's why he ended up just dumping him near a dumpster. So again, this is the kind of behavior that actually leaks out information about the offender unintentionally. So now we know we're not looking for somebody who's 6'3", 285 pounds, mm-hmm. and a bodybuilder. It's not somebody who physically overpowers his victims, but somebody who probably does the opposite. He underwhelms them. He makes them lower their guard because he doesn't look threatening or physically imposing.
He fools a lot of people, and yes, I think that, you know, an unassuming person and being able to ensure that he's not seen as a risk or a threat in any way, shape or form. And as you said, it tells us lots of little bits of information. If this was being profiled when it should have been after, you know, the second victim, they would have actually been able to garner an awful lot of information from the victimology and from the crime scenes. And there's a lot of information that we can build just from the little bits that we do know. And of course, Jim, you and I looked at this with James Fitzgerald when we were doing our LMN show, Killer Profile. And I think this was number five, wasn't it, in those cases?
Yeah.
And we did go through victim by victim, but of course there are many here in the time that we're trying to get through it on our podcast. So that Angel, and then sequentially, you know, we're not sure exactly of the order either of whether Kenneth Randolph was after Angel. What did you find out about him?
Nothing.
Zero.
Nothing. There's absolutely nothing that we found out about this poor victim.
Anybody out there does know anything about him, please bring his bio to my attention, because you try every iteration of trying to find information about him, and it's just, he's just lumped in there,
right.
You know, and it's, you know, we apologize
victim.
To anybody listening to this who knew him or part of his family. It's just, there's just nothing that we could find.
Right, but we would like to give him a voice if you do know him or any of these other victims. The families of any of these victims are welcome to contact us through Twitter or Facebook and let us know what you can about the person that was behind each of these victims, because we would love to give them an opportunity to show what their loved one was like as a real person and not just a label and an unfortunate victim in this horrific serial killer case.
And it could be that some families just didn't want to talk to the press and they, you know, they stayed away. Certainly there were other families that we know a lot more about the victims because they did come forward or they were interviewed or whatnot. And that could be, they just wanted their privacy. And so maybe that's why we don't know as much about them. But and in any case, if anybody does want to reach out, please do. I'd love to hear from you.
And when we come back, we'll talk about another major change in MO for this particular serial killer, because for the first time, he kills a white victim.
Michael Barnett, he was one of our first white male victims, and he had some previous history for being involved in drug activity and did not have a steady life that we were able to track, and with a three-week gap between the last time he was seen and the time he was found, it was pretty difficult.
When we get to the next victim, who is Michael Barnett, he's the first white victim found, and he was found on October 9th, 2004. And the body was decomposed, but it was found in a storage unit, and that was another dramatic change. In other words, instead of having this victim thrown on the side of the road in some ditch or under a bridge or in some bushes, he was actually found in a storage unit. And that, what does that tell you, Laura, about how this offender might be evolving at this point?
You would think from this that perhaps there's some preparatory behavior here, and perhaps he knows exactly where he's going to take the next victim and wants to spend more time with the victim. And certainly from accounts that I've read, it seems that having taken him there and tied him up, he did spend time almost, telling him what he was going to do beforehand and enjoying that moment of this victim in particular finding that out and being terrified. So I think it's more about time being spent and preparation and, stalking ground and finding places. I doubt he just happened upon that particular storage unit and found it empty at that particular time. He would have had to have done some preparatory work there, which, we know that he did escalate and we know he became more and more prolific.
Right. And so we can start building the profile of this guy by looking at his choice of victim. So he's doing the easy pickings. And typically that indicates to us somebody who isn't very sophisticated themselves, somebody who isn't living the high life and having a very complicated job and a profession and very well educated. It's somebody different than that. So he is taking advantage of this community in a way that helps him get away with his crimes into the future. So that's the first part. But when you start seeing him now spending more time with the victims, and I think this may be the first victim that they actually determined had been raped, and which should have completely changed the tenor and nature of this investigation. And later they would find out, and not only was he raped, but he was tied up with ligatures. And that became very obvious in this case. And some of the previous cases, there were ligature marks as well. And so that was something that was kind of inconsistent with the fact that there weren't there wasn't evidence of any blunt force trauma. So many times if you have somebody who is abducting other people and these people are, healthy, strong individuals, they have to be overcome. And so if you see that happening, you will infer that there was either a gun used or a knife used to control them. But then usually the cause of death is that gun or a knife. And in these cases, that wasn't the case. They were all asphyxiated, and some of them were strangled, and it looked like manual strangulation. Others, it was ligature strangulation. So that's an anomaly. Like, why, if he had a gun or a knife, would he resort to strangulation? And the answer, of course, behaviorally is because he wanted to be up close and personal. He didn't want to use an instrument. He wanted to do it himself. And that's another aspect of this profile. And we would find out with this particular victim, Michael Barnett, that he actually would torture him mentally by telling him after he got him tied up by telling him what he was going to do to him.
Is there a significance that all of the black victims up to this time were left out in the open? You know, he didn't care who found them. But this white victim, somehow to him, he gave more care to and hid the body where it wouldn't be found. Like, subconsciously, does he know that this victim is going to get more attention?
It's possible. Maybe subconsciously or maybe very consciously that he did that. Maybe he felt that all the black victims or non-white victims that he murdered before were sort of marginalized and as it was quoted, taking out the trash. Or maybe it was something that that he felt a particular need to hide this victim more because of the fact that he was white, and maybe that's going to garner more press. It was probably a savvy move on his part. It also could be that this change, this fairly radical change in victim selection criterion, and just for people who may not know how we determine that or how offenders determine that, it's based on availability, vulnerability, and desirability. And it may be that in this particular case, this particular victim was available and vulnerable, but not his desired category. And sometimes desirability can be the factor that's just thrown out because this person is available and he can take advantage of this person. So one of the things that we learn later on when RD is actually captured is that he has done some very sadistic things to this particular victim. He's raped this victim after he has tied him up. He's immobilized him by tying up his ankles and tying up his wrist behind his back. But at that point, he then tells the victim that he's going to rape and kill him. And that is the sadistic part of it. So no matter what, I mean, this guy comes across as non-threatening enough to get this person, the victims, into a vulnerable position, tied up. And we would later learn, wouldn't we, Laura, that what he did was he feigned that he was afraid that these guys would rape him. So let me just tie up your ankles and your wrists so that I know you won't be in a position to rape me. And in fact, he intended to all along rape them and murder them.
He certainly played the victim card. I mean, that's what he claimed the whole way through. But of course, we don't really know whether there's too much truth in that, other than his demeanor would point to him being a fairly pathetic individual, just in terms of even the way that he comes across on his interviews. But he certainly fooled a lot of people, and that's why, you know, even in what he says, it's his account. But I think there's definitely something about his sadistic nature. He really enjoyed the power and control and taking that back. And that was all part of his whole rape script. So we've covered a huge amount already, and this seems like a good time to pause, and we'll get back to it in more detail in our next pod. So thank you so much for listening to Real Crime Profile, and please feel free to hit us up on Facebook and Twitter with questions that you have, and we'll cover them in the next pod. So if you want to help us out on the show, please can you go to wandry.com/survey and complete the little survey about us. And it shouldn't take more than 5 minutes. You can even do it from your phone. So that's wandry.com/survey. It will take you just a few minutes to complete, and it will really help us out, giving us some more information about you and why you listen to Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214 946 4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.